time to wake up with Bill Finch. 203-333-9422. Only on WICC 600 and 95.9, the voice of Connecticut.
And welcome to Wake Up, your radio home for truth, justice, and democracy. This is your radio home if you're tired of being divided and manipulated, tired of the right-wing whiners and liars of other talk radio, home to those who are tired of entertainment masquerading it as news, tired of your internet being exploited by propagandists, for those who are tired of the science deniers, billionaires, bullies, climate deniers. We'll fight for you. We're not tired, and every Sunday we'll re-energize ourselves. Are you tired of those who won't fight the scourge of gun violence, who openly defy our laws and our sacred constitution? Tired of those who aren't fighting for everyday workers, the poor, the elderly, and the desperately needed housing and better schools while passing massive tax breaks for the financial elites? If you're tired and you want to do something about it, Wake Up will help strengthen you for the battles ahead. For 1 hour every Sunday, we bring you guests who provide a patriotic, full-throated endorsement of the pillars of our democracy and red meat for the ideals that built this great nation. Today, I'm going to bring you a voice I think you'll need to hear. I'm your host, Bill Finch, and I'd like to welcome to the show State Representative Antonio Felipe, a youthful Bridgeport leader from a well-known political family and at the firestorm of getting Connecticut back in the housing game. Good morning and welcome, Antonio.
Good morning, Bill. It's nice to hear from you.
Well, it's always good to see your smiling face around the Capitol, Antonio. You started at the ripe old age representing the constituents of Bridgeport, South End, and West End. At what age?
23 years old.
23, America. This is the future. This is one of our Latino leaders, one of our young leaders in Bridgeport who's out to help change his city, his district, and make the world a better place. And he's been active in many, many ways in the legislature and in the local community. I'd like to talk first with you, Antonio, knowing a little bit about you, seeing you grow up, seeing the amazing advocate that you've become. What's your story, and why do you do what you do? It takes a lot of time out of your personal life and your family life. Why do you do it?
I think I'll start with the story, because it's really integral to that point. I grew up in the city of Bridgeport on the west side, Laurel Avenue, and spent part of my time in the South End. And those are actually both districts I represent now. And I went to Elias House School. And in Elias House School, for kindergarten, I went to Bassett because we were overcrowded. And then I finally got to go to the actual Elias Howe building for about 2 years until we went to Longfellow. And Longfellow didn't have a gymnasium. Elias Howe didn't have a cafeteria. And Bassett High School, especially on the junior floor at that time, was no place for a kindergarten kid to be. We went through a lot of different challenges in the school system. And then I just went home and realized that my family was struggling at times. Obviously, you've seen the growth of that, right? My father started off as a student at Housatonic Community College, worked for Housatonic Community College, and then got an opportunity to work for Mayor John Fabrizi, where he then transitioned to work for Mayor Bill Finch. So throughout my childhood, we definitely had our times of kind of coming up through the ranks from being in real poverty to being in a place where we could support ourselves, but our neighbors were still right there. They were still dealing with these same challenges, still dealing with the housing shortage, still dealing with all of the lack of education, the lack of jobs. So coming through that, obviously my father working for a couple of mayors, working on campaigns, I get involved around the age of 16, doing database management and helping out some campaigns. And then when I was 18, I got to run a campaign. I ran Christopher Rosario's 2014 race. I helped manage Governor Malloy. And, Representative Chris Rosario was my mentor, somebody who I consider a family member of mine. He's a deputy speaker in the House of Representatives and honestly somebody who, as chair of the Black and Puerto Rican Caucus when he was, really prepared me to be chair now, as I'm doing in my current role.
Well,
all that prepared me to be here and do these things and
so many people.
Yeah.
So many people.
I always say.
Go ahead.
I always say this, and I just want to make sure I get it on the record for the last time, because there's a couple of younger cats coming up, so I'm not the youngest anymore. But I used to say I represent a generation never represented before. And that's why we need young leadership, because there are challenges that folks are going through. The cost of owning a home, it's ridiculous, and it puts people in a really tight spot.
Well, listen, you know, I admire your entire family. Your younger brother always is there knocking on doors with me for whatever candidate or cause we're out there for. Your father is like a brother to me, and your family has meant so much to the city of Bridgeport. I hope people appreciate what the Felipe family has meant and what they've meant to other candidates like Christopher Rosario, who's now a state leader and a national leader in the Latino elected official organizations. You know, so I have to make this observation, not to, you know, sugarcoat you too much, but a lot of people haven't done what Antonio's done. A lot of people have grown up in poverty and left it behind. Now, you certainly don't live in poverty now. You're in the working class, and you have the means to support yourself, but you have stayed in the neighborhood. You have stayed there working for people, and so many people flee to the suburbs, and you know, some of that's what we're talking about now, right? That the people, the urban flight, the flight to the suburbs, the white flight, some people call it, has been very damaging to our cities. And we're gonna just give you a chance for a couple minutes to talk about that and how that's impacted you and your motivation. And then we're going to be taking a break in about 2 minutes. Why don't you fill us in on what you've seen in terms of people staying and fighting? We want to try to wake up people. You talk about new kids coming in. Who are they, and how do we wake up this generation and others?
Yeah, I think you've seen it in a couple of ways, right? Across the state, you have Representatives Dan Gajewski and MJ Shannon from even more conservative constituencies that are serving right now at 24 years old, and it's great to see. You saw a young man, the same
chairing
age as
the Environment Committee as well.
No, Bumgarner is vice chairing. The Environment Committee, he got elected at 19.
Yeah.
So there's that as well. And then you look in the city of Bridgeport, just on a micro level, in my same district as a council person, you had Tyler Mack, who was my age, running for city council, doing very well when he was there. Obviously, he's moved on now to raise his family in a better neighborhood, but he's still in Bridgeport. And for me, I represent the district that raised me. I say that all the time. And for me, it's to give back to those people. I don't move out because I don't feel like I need to move out. I love the people that I represent. I love the people that I live next to. My neighbors are some of my favorite people. And while I might be doing a little bit better, I can still be doing better with them rather than leaving them behind.
Well, as a former South Ender who moved to a different neighborhood in the city but had been on Lafayette Street for many, many years, I want to thank you for all that you've done, especially for the South End, for helping the University of Bridgeport get back on its feet. And your father is involved on the Board of Trustees. We're going to take a break, and we're going to come right back in a few minutes to hear about the controversy surrounding getting Connecticut back building affordable housing. We'll be back after these messages.
Join the conversation, 203-333-9422. Back to Wake Up with Bill Finch, live on WICC 600 and 95.9. The Voice of Connecticut.
Well, let's face it, listeners, we have a national dilemma with a president who is acting extra constitutionally every 5 minutes, doesn't understand the Declaration of Independence, doesn't understand the Constitution, is unaware of the pillars of democracy that we so often talk about on this show. So we have a disaster of a national government right now, a divided Congress, a far right wing president, authoritarian in his aims, dissolving the very constitutional freedoms that we all depend on. Certainly, his corruption is magnificent in its scale. $100 million jets, millions in his pocket in his personal Bitcoin anonymously, international deals where he gets golf course development rights for opening up chips that were previously banned under the Biden administration to Qatar because it will ultimately get in the hands of the Chinese. This makes Watergate look like a picnic. And I was at the Watergate hearings. I was very much against President Nixon for what he did. But this is disgusting in levels that Nixon could not even have imagined. So we have that on the national level. People are seeking counseling because of the depression. People are thinking of moving out of the country because of this disgusting human being. And yet, on the state level, we have heroes like Antonio Felipe and others who are carving climate change legislation. They're carving AI legislation. They're carving workers' rights out when we have a country that's against workers having collective bargaining rights, women having ability to choose what to do with their own body. But in Connecticut, we are this little light under a bushel basket, and it's because of people like Antonio Felipe. He has charged the barricades, some would say, against even parts of Connecticut that don't want affordable housing, and he has won. He has won. He has helped pass a monumental housing bill that will stop people from stopping development that's needed in the area of housing. And just to introduce this, we all know that if we have density, we need rental apartments. Renters own on average about one car. Homeowners on average own about two cars. If you develop a suburb for homeowners, you need to have plenty of room for at least two cars for each homeowner. In a city, you don't have that. You have half or less. In fact, it's even more. Density, we know, helps us fight climate change because we have more people sharing walls, sharing ceilings, sharing transit, sharing sidewalks, sharing bicycle lanes. And so we know that cities will pollute far, far less than suburbs. And if you look at the density per square mile, we don't have very many dense places in Connecticut, although some people would say that I'm kind of dense, but present company accepted. 10,000 square miles density, 0.3 cars per person. 7.5 square miles, people per square mile, 0.6 of a car. 5,000 to 7,500 people per square mile, 0.8 cars, getting up to almost one car. Less than 5,000 people per square mile, which is basically first-tier suburbs, 1.1 car. And the further you move out, the more cars you have. The less dense it is, you have more money, you buy more cars, you buy more consumption, you pollute more, you warm the climate more. Connecticut is a little bit under 10,000, which means 0.3 cars per person. Yet we see time after time after time, people who do not want to build housing, though we need it desperately, will kill projects because of parking requirements. Antonio, unleash your inner advocate here and tell us what you did and how you did it.
Yeah, I think I'm going to stick a little bit away from the parking requirements stuff because in Bridgeport it gets a little sticky. But we did a lot to make sure that we were building more in Connecticut, and I think that is very important. We made sure we incentivized housing authorities to be able to connect with one another. So if you don't have a housing authority in your community but you would like affordable housing built, we have an incentive of housing unit equivalent points on top of your original housing unit equivalent points to be able to build more housing.
And that
if you connect with the housing authority, up to you.
Those points get you more money for your schools?
No, those points get you closer to what we call an 830G moratorium, which means that you will be able to to avoid being sued under 830G statutes for a number of years because you got enough points towards your moratorium to not have to build as much affordable housing.
Right.
But it incentivizes it on the front end. It makes sure that you build, and every unit that you build will get you a point. But we have certain incentives like this one that adds a quarter point on top of that, which gets you a little bit closer. We had a governor's bill in here that works with density and says that if you build multifamily housing as of right on 10% of the land in your community, you will then get 0.25 percentage points taken off of your moratorium. You need to get 2% to get to your moratorium. This brings it down to 1.75, and your second moratorium is 1.5. This brings it down to 1.25% more affordable housing. It puts places like New Canaan, who I know are trying to build more affordable housing, in a position to do so at a rate that fits them, to do so for multifamily housing, which fits better than maybe doing large apartment buildings, and creates a larger housing stock, which we know people will move on up from a place they can very much afford to a place they can comfortably afford, and allow more housing stock to be available for people on the bottom.
Well, I'm not running for office and I'm not in office, but I can tell you that what I have noticed throughout my life is that many times people say parking when they really mean race, or they really mean someone different than them. And it gives the polite conversation in Connecticut a veneer of acceptability. And I think it is important. Look, I live in a city. I don't want a high rise going up next to my house. I have a residential neighborhood. We do have zoning. But it doesn't necessarily mean that you can stop a development on in a nice residential neighborhood on a corner lot, which doesn't affect the rest of the neighborhood, from having some more density. I think it gives people, in my opinion, that your bill gives people more freedom to pursue the goals that we all say that we believe in, and more freedom to do it with carrots and sticks. Is that true?
I don't think there are many sticks in this bill, if I'm being honest with you. We incentivize most things. We make most of it optional. Even the piece of it called Towns Take the Lead, which isn't exactly optional, is just people creating a plan to build their affordable housing and giving us reasons as to why they wouldn't be able to build up to the level that was put out in a fair share study.
Yeah. Yeah.
So right now, let's say Bridgeport, for example, under Allocation Plan 1, which is the one that we went through, Allocation Plan A, I should say, we are supposed to build 661 more units of affordable housing, obviously because we have a large affordable housing stock already. Our bill says you have to do a quarter of that, which let's just say a flat, 180, and then you have to give a plan for how you can build it or why you can't get to that number. If we see those reasons, we can then use those reasons to further legislate. Let's say a place like Monroe says we just don't have the space. We can figure out how to do maybe smaller minimum lot sizes, more ADUs, things like that, to try to figure out how to help them address their affordable housing shortage instead of prescribing it to everybody carte blanche.
Well, I think that's a very important point, because up till now, developers have used the affordable housing law to break down local zoning. And it sounds to me like you're sort of going, as good politicians and good public policy officials would be, sort of in the middle there. You know, it was always, I'll see you in court. If you don't give me this development, I'm going to build a high rise. And now you've really kind of tempered and forced people to deal with the issue of 830G. When I was in the Senate, Antonio, I don't know if you know this or not, but I opposed it because at the time, the only units built under the Affordable Housing Act in Connecticut were in Trumbull, which was my district. And I thought it was so hypocritical for all the other suburbs to say, we want this, we're going to vote for this bill and then not have any of the, affordable units. So I opposed it because it wasn't fair. And I said, I'll support appropriations, funding, direct subsidies, more tax credits for everyone to build affordable housing. Because in Bridgeport, we want to build affordable housing. We just don't always have the comparable values. As you heard on the previous show about real estate, we have to, in order to make the buildings come up out of the ground, there has to be someone willing to build it. The state doesn't build it itself. It incents private developers. People often forget that. So if we see the units coming up at Steel Point, for example, Antonio, why don't you explain to the listeners how some of those units are financed? Oh, you know what? Let me save that answer for after the news, because I just noticed it's 8:30 and Andrea has to take us right to the news right now.
Talking about what matters to you this morning. Wake up with Bill Finch. WICC 695.9, the voice of Connecticut.
Are you woke up yet? Bridgeport, Milford, Stratford, Fairfield. Listen, we've got a great guest here for you. I'll only mention it once because it was a great, great season for all Knick fans. My condolences go out to Antonio, our guest, and all the other loyal Knick fans. My two eldest children are Knick fans, and they haven't had much to cheer about all their life. I'm a Celtics fan, but I was rooting for the Knicks. Mr. Brunson, et cetera. They did a great job. Hats off to the Knicks. Let's hear it for the Knicks. Good job, Knicks. And enough said on that, because there's always next year. And there's the Mets playing, right, Antonio?
Absolutely.
All right. So listen, Felipe is Mr. Connecticut in so many ways. He already told us he went to Laurel Avenue, named after the mountain laurel, which is our state's flower. He attended Elias Howe School, named after Elias Howe, the inventor of the sewing machine, who during the Civil War partnered with Abraham Lincoln to clothe all of the federal troops and gave us a huge advantage in winning the war against slavery and the fascist movement from the South. He went to Longfellow School, poet laureate of the United States in so many ways, Henry Wadsworth Longfellow. And then he went to Bassac High School. Mr. Bassac, an explorer, an inventor, an industrialist. Unfortunately, his experience at a high school was that of a kindergartner. Not a good thing to do, but the Bridgeport school system in so many ways is driven to desperation to take care of our children. We do have two Connecticuts. That's one of the things this show is always pointing out. We have a white suburban Connecticut with high incomes, and we have a pigmented population living in the poor urban zip codes. It's not fair. We fought against it all our life. Antonio is the next generation who's breaking this out, helping to level the playing field and make Connecticut not two states, but one. And I give him a lot of credit because he's had to take – how long were you on the floor to get this this bill out of the House, Antonio?
11 and a half hours, and unfortunately I missed all of Game 5 of that Knicks series you talked about.
Which was one of the ones that we want to remember. tell people what it's like. I mean, we saw Chris Murphy on the filibuster on the floor of the Senate for 16 or 17 hours. We saw Cory Booker for 26 or 27 hours against the unconstitutional behavior of the man in the White House. What's it like to listen to the questions, some of which were not well-formed, some of which were kind of silly? They all had to eat up the clock, some of which were really good questions. How do you stay on your feet that long, and how do you take some of the questions that you know are the silly questions, how do you take them serious without insulting somebody?
I think you have to stay even keeled. You have to make sure that you are looking at all the good that you've done in your piece of legislation, especially if you really believe in it, which I do. Look at the $50 million in bonding that we put towards affordable housing every year. The ability for some of our unions to use their pension funds in order to build affordable housing with a match from the state, meaning that we will have more affordable housing built by folks who do the building. It's really important for us to really remember as we're going through those debates, those long debates on the floor, that people are going to ask questions that are driven by their district. As you said, we are one of the most segregated states in the United States of America. So there's 169 different municipalities. They all look at the world a little bit different than the others, even our cities and our rural areas.
Even some parts of the city look at things differently than other parts of the city.
Absolutely. And I think it's important for us to sit there, understand that these folks might have a different experience. Try to answer their questions the best that you can, even if you don't agree with them. Push back subtly, but not disrespectfully. And, you know, in my case, I knew we had the votes, so I was just doing my best job until I knew we were going to win.
I think a lot of people have always had respect for you and your family. But after, a situation like that that you went through with flying colors, respecting everyone, listening to questions, some good, some not so good, and answering them all seriously, is something that elevates you to the level of a state of Connecticut statesman. And who knows, maybe beyond that at some point. But I want to talk to you a little bit about how this impacts on Bridgeport, our beloved hometown, where we saw during the administration that your father served projects like Crescent Crossing, Steel Point, Cherry Street Apartments. We had come out of a cloud of corruption. John Fabrizi and I had to reestablish the city's credibility. It takes many years to do that. And with your father's help, your brother's help, many of the people that you work with help, we were able to get a significant, I think it was about 1,000 units of housing under construction. But we've got to maintain that, right? And I think everyone would say that we've slowed a little bit. But I think your efforts at the state level, hand in hand with what the city can do, should provide a future similar to our recent past, where we're looking at breaking ground on 1,000 or 2,000 units of housing every few years. And with the ability to leverage the unions who I work with, the great building trades of Connecticut, listeners should know they have their pension funds invested in many things to provide for their members in retirement. Those funds can, in some places, be invested in housing, like we did with Cherry Street Apartments. All of those apartments, that's your district, correct?
It used to be my district. It's now Steve Stashman's after redistricting.
Yeah. Moved it a little bit eastward. You know, one of the most important things we did in my administration, I believe, next to Steel Point and the fuel cell and the parks, was the housing initiative in Cherry Street, fueled by a fuel cell. Okay, Connecticut Fuel Cell is powering that facility with a charter school and about 200 units of housing with 1,000 people on the waiting list, really proved that you can do this with old factory buildings, old commercial buildings. I know that you had a bill, 502, that allowed union funds to leverage state funds. And then in turn, which it doesn't always happen, because let's face it, there's 4 jobs in Bridgeport that are going on, including Steel Point, that were shut down for labor law violations and wage theft because we didn't have good developers that were obeying the law. These projects that we did with building trades who are unionized were never shut down, always obeyed the law, and were done on budget, on time, with no injuries. So in my frame of reference, and I'm glad the legislature's done this, we'll have projects funded by local workers' retirement benefits, hiring local workers who aren't being shut down for wage theft and are building this much-needed housing. Tell us a little bit about how you were able to get 502 passed for union funds to be used. Tell us a little bit how you got the $50 million in affordable every year for however many years that's going to last. And tell us a little bit about your vision, Antonio, for... Because it isn't about arguments and debates. It's about hammers and nails and front door keys that unlock and keep you safe. That's what it's about. It's about a place to raise your family. Tell me more about your vision and the fights that you've gone through and your accomplishments for housing and affordable housing in Connecticut.
Yeah, I mean, firstly, when we talk about 5002, I try to be abundantly clear about how it all started. It started in January, and I need to thank Representatives Turco, Sims, Jeff Luxemburg, Lenny Cabral-Segura, and Kadeem Roberts, as well as the Majority Leader, Jason Rojas. We sat in rooms with the building trades, for example, even amongst our own staff when it comes to the $50 million to support affordable housing, which is not actually the building trades grant program. That's a separate program. There's 2 programs that we're creating here. And the vision of the future is honestly trying to figure out how to do more for our renters, more for our homeless population. There's some good stuff in that bill for our homeless population, but we really need to make sure we're providing them with good services, but also keeping rent down and making sure that people can stay in their houses, because the best homelessness prevention is housing people. We know that.
Oh, yeah. It's Don't to lose make sure it in the first that we are, place, right?
Yeah. And it's also to make sure that we're providing tax credits where it makes sense, whether it's people that are housing folks from the IDD community that might have problems working, people housing folks that are coming out of incarceration that might need to get back on their feet. People housing recently homeless folks who have depleted all their funds just trying to scrape by and live. I mean, there are families right now where both parents work 40 hours a week and they don't have enough money to afford housing. They're living in their cars with their children.
We're going to have
and
to take
constraints on that.
We're going to have to take a quick break. We all know, and we're so proud of you to bring this up, people living on each other's couches, living in the back of their car. We know people that are doing that because there just isn't enough sticks and bricks with safe front doors and a key for them to enter. We're going to get right back after this brief break with Antonio Felipe, state representative from Bridgeport, one of the new, young, vibrant leaders in Connecticut. We'll be right back after this.
Wake Up with Bill Finch is live on WICC 600 and 95.9, the voice of Connecticut. Speak your mind, 203-333-9422.
Well, listen, you know, a state representative at this time of the year their time is very valuable. We just heard Antonio Felipe tell you that for 11 hours he stood on his feet answering all sorts of questions about why Connecticut should build affordable housing. We know the answer is obvious. We need it to be built for the people who are living in their cars and doubling up on couches and whatever they're doing to just stay out of the weather. We know this because we live in Bridgeport, where this has happened to our neighbors. And I think Antonio is right to say that many people have different perspectives in Connecticut because they live in areas where that does not exist. And when you're a young person in the legislature knowing this, it's got to be incredibly frustrating when people don't understand where you came from and how desperate some of the needs are. And they can also often sound cavalier. I remember when Christa McCarthy Vahey, God bless her soul, was bringing out the adoptees' rights to their own birth certificates, which the government was keeping from them. I watched that entire debate 2 years ago, maybe three now, and some of the questions from some of the far-right members on the other side of the aisle made adoptees sort of sound like hamburgers or commodities. And it was hard as a social worker who has counseled adoptees who were prohibited from knowing their identity by our government. Let's just say it like it is. It was hard for her to maintain a straight face and to not say, "Are you kidding me?" You know. And I know you probably had a couple of those moments, so I just want to publicly thank you. You showed poise under pressure, and it's so important. Now you're going to be coming into the budget debate, and I know that Speaker Ritter and President Looney of the Senate are working hard with the governor's staff. Let me just say before you comment how incredibly important it was for Democrats under Malloy and under Lamont to put our financial house back in order, because all the wonderful liberal things that you and I believe in and want to do for poor people and lift them up and create a better middle class opportunity for them requires a healthy state of Connecticut, which we did not have until Democrats bit the bullet and turned the fiscal ship around, filling up our rainy day fund, paying what we need on pensions. It occurs to me when I went to New York State, Antonio, and I don't know if I told you this story, but I don't think I've mentioned it here on the show, but when I had the privilege of running the New York State Thruway, I asked the budget director, Rob Mojica, in New York, why Connecticut was so messed up financially and New York was so solid. And he said there's only one reason. It's we put in the required amount every year to fully fund our pension obligations to our employees, and you don't. And from a brilliant man who runs the state budget that's probably the third largest in the United States compared to the United States government in California, that was really telling. One thing, fill the funds up you're supposed to fill up, fulfill your obligations. That's what the guardrails do. We know there's pressing social ills. Under what circumstances, Antonio, do you think we need to relax them, if at all? And give us your vision for the state's finances over the next few years that you'll be serving the state of Connecticut.
Yeah, I thank you for that question. I think the biggest way I would like to look at that is not relaxing them, it's not getting rid of them, it's reimagining them. There needs to be a structure in place. I think you're absolutely right. You pay down your obligations, you make sure you're taking care of the people you need to take care of. But there are $5 billion in funds we didn't have access to. And, you know, we call our rainy day fund the rainy day fund. And you talked about the two Connecticuts, and one of them, it's been raining for a very long time.
Through the roof.
And I'm not saying that we empty the entire fund out, but I've said, you know, you got to give somebody an umbrella every once in a while,
yeah,
just so they can cross the street, just so they can get to the next place that they're going. So we do need to relax a little bit. We need to definitely commit some more state bonding. I understand that our governor has been a little conservative when it comes to bonding dollars, hoping that we will stay in a good financial place. I just don't agree that it has to be as staunch as he is on it. We can balance better. We can make sure that we're spending for people without emptying all of our coffers. We can still save and also save lives. So when it comes to doing some of these things, like our ask every year is $50 million for homelessness. I think in our budget, we get about 12. It's really telling that we can't do those small things. I understand people are asking for things like $285 million for nonprofits or a similar amount for Medicaid, which I think is super important because obviously the federal government is putting that at risk. But at the same time, he's putting HUD at risk. So we need those homelessness funds as well. I just think there are so many small things that we can do. You know, a few million dollars here, a few million dollars there. Out of that surplus that we see, that really serve people, that will give directly back to the economy because they'll be able to spend their money on the things that they need.
Right.
And we need to start investing in the state of Connecticut because you can't get a return on an investment that you don't make.
It is such an important point you make, and it's a little hypocritical, I think, for the other party to talk about the cost of living as they do when it comes to utility costs and others. And yet the people who are having the most difficulty with the cost of living are the poor and the working class that you and I have represented all of our lives, and you now actively as a state representative. You know, one of the things listeners don't know, and you could speak convincingly about the declining amounts of funds that are available for cities to help the poor. When Richard Nixon instituted community development block grants, it was one of the most progressive pieces of urban legislation we had seen since Johnson and Kennedy. And it was highly popular, very popular among mayors. And yet, since its inception, it has only declined. Congress, more and more controlled by right-wing forces that don't care about the poor, have never, and even the majority party, when the Democrats in the majority party, we do not increase CDBG funds, and they're so important. When we had the energy block grants, and the mayors saved tons and tons and tons and tons of money, that was eliminated. The Pequot funds in the state of Connecticut, the same thing. In order for gambling to become illegal, we had to give the wealthy a break on their capital gains in order to get their votes. And in order to get city votes, we needed to hold out the hope of a casino somewhere in a city, which never materialized. But we also had to create the Pequot funds. And that's how you got the votes, in some to some extent, for legalized gambling. And we've seen Pequot funds decline, 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 decline ever since they've been instituted. What can you do, Antonio? You have been so respectful in your pleading. You have been so insightful and intelligent in your arguments. What can we do together to reach the suburban voters, suburban representatives especially, to paint this picture, to see increasing costs, increasing needs in the city, and declining revenues, and over-reliance on the most regressive tax, the property tax?
I think we just need to understand that folks need to see people that aren't painted with, that can't be painted with a broad brush. When they look at people fleeting, they go, oh, those are poor people from cities. They're not all poor people from cities. Some of them are from those districts.
Eastern Connecticut.
Some of our more.
Eastern Connecticut
right.
has but some of the same demographics.
Not only Eastern Connecticut, but even from our more suburban districts.
Sure.
Folks that just understand that we need to do more for people. Right. People who just have, you know, a philanthropic heart about them.
Right.
And we need to be giving back as much as we possibly can because, listen, it's better for everyone.
Yeah.
If you want to lower your taxes, you need more people paying taxes or people paying more taxes. I know that the governor is always talking about more taxpayers, having more people move here into the state of Connecticut.
Sure.
Which is great, but I think we need more taxes. If you take people who are struggling, who are poor, and give them more money, they're just going to spend it on the things that they've needed but couldn't afford.
Sure.
And that's more tax base right there. So I'm going to say it a second time. We can't get a return on an investment that we don't make. And we need to start investing in people instead of in investing in politics.
Whoa. I wish that was our concluding remark because that was prophetic. Let's talk about you for a second and the Bridgeport political situation. What do you see on the horizon for Bridgeport politics? It's been through a lot of controversy recently. Certainly none of it has touched you or your family or Christopher Rosario, who is often talked about as a possible candidate for mayor. How does it affect your view of the future to have this cloud hanging over us, and what can you do about it? Obviously, you live a good, clean life, and you're not a person involved with anything near corruption, and you've done a great job to pursue your ideals. How do we lift Bridgeport up and past this cloud?
I think going forward, we just do it right. We understand that there are things that have happened in the recent past and surely in the past before that were unlawful and you know, put a lot of people at risk and also hurt the legitimacy of some of our candidates and some of the ways that people see Bridgeport politics. But we have an opportunity this summer, as our city council people and some of our Board of Education members go up for re-election, to do it better. Obviously, I intend, and I know my colleagues in the House and Senate intend to do it better in 2026. And just moving forward, we need to be sure that we're being above board, that we're being respectful of every voter and making sure that every vote is properly collected and properly counted.
Well, I want to thank you for being our guest here. I think that if more politicians were like Antonio Felipe, our state of Connecticut would be in much better shape. I have seen you grow from a young man to a statewide leader. Certainly, your status was elevated a great deal by getting this housing bill through and by explaining some of the things that people painted as more controversial than they really were. You kept your head about you. You kept to the facts. You were polite and resourceful. And I think the state, looking back on that moment of your 11 hours on your feet, will owe you a deep debt of gratitude. I know I certainly already do. I want to just say thank you to your dad, Ruben, who raised a great son.